Let Yourself Go, Chapter 1. One day I was sitting in the kitchen as my mother arrived from the grocery store and started unloading groceries, as she had probably done almost once every day for at least 30 years. But she hummed, and there was a joyous zip to her step. She suddenly turned to me and said in a triumphant tone, "You won't believe it! I saw Nancy at the grocery store. I haven't seen her in about 10 years, and she has let herself go." I had only heard of Nancy by reputation as an elegant member of Lake Forest social elite, but my mother offered me no further details on this peculiar nugget of information, probably because she didn't want to display the cattiness she was secretly enjoying. Quite likely, glamorous Nancy was the life of a party, surrounded by a phalanx of men only too eager to laugh at her jokes, pour her a drink, or swing her around the dance floor. Lake Forest was populated by a swell set, who might hire the band Cream to play at their daughter's debut, rocking out on a dance floor placed at the bottom of an empty swimming pool. While this might have been Nancy's milieu, it was not something my parents were part of, I think by mutual agreement. I never thought of my mother as a beautiful woman. Several times she did confide in me that when she was younger, some people thought that she looked like Ingrid Bergman. However, she always said this with a roll of her eyes and a shake of her head, implying that everyone was crazy to think she could ever aspire to the cool elegance of this international movie star. While I could see the vague resemblance to Ingrid Bergman in pictures of her in her 20s, at this point she was deep in the throes of mothering 6 children and clearly had no time for elegance. My mother never had any interest in style, almost to the point of excess. She could spend the entire day in a one-piece bathing suit that looked more like a children's romper. She loved playing tennis in her bathing suit, and on the occasions that she was required to wear white, she seemed to delight in producing some old rumpled outfit and completed the look by wearing black socks. She abhorred shopping and only had a couple of outfits for the few formal parties that my parents did attend. One of her classic outfits was her pink peekaboo dress. This dress featured a really rather sedate rectangular cutout centered above her modish cleavage, but she loved pasting things into the cutout. I remember one evening she sailed off to a party with S&H green stamps decorating her chest. Collecting green stamps did not carry any social cachet in our affluent suburb, and in fact was something that you would do only very discreetly, but my mother chose to blatantly wear the stamps on her chest. Another evening she pasted dark black dog hair in the cutout. I truly don't think that this was premeditated and was not designed to send any particular message. She just wanted to cause a stir. I envision her looking into the mirror thinking, how should I enhance this dress tonight? And glancing around the room, she spotted the lazy dog, grabbed some scissors and thought, that's just the ticket. My father was so horrified at this performance, he banned the peekaboo dress to the back of the closet, never to be seen again. Clearly, from a starting point of Ingrid Bergman, my mother had let herself go, in terms of elegance, but she did it with such a conscious and refreshing style. Perhaps she knew that she could not compete with the upper echelon, but more likely she simply had no interest and considered this a losing long-term strategy anyway. Certainly my mother craved being the life of the party, but her strategy centered around playful humor and clever wit. In addition to her sartorial tweaks at elegant society, she was always ready to entertain with a poem or skit to commemorate birthdays and weddings. She amassed all of these efforts into a bulging blue binder. Leafing through it, I can see the passage of time, with poems written for the same person on his 40th, 50th, and 60th birthday. I can envision party after party where she arrived with a guitar that she discreetly hid in the coat closet, waiting for the right time for her performance. Leaping up after dinner, she would begin her serenade, which frequently included a chorus that all the celebrants could raucously participate in. Nancy might have burned brightly, but as my mother so triumphantly realized, Nancy's tenure in the spotlight inevitably succumbed to age and disrepair, while my mother could still command the stage and bring the house down well into her 70s. I remember one time when I was about 10, I asked my mother what the word sexy meant. She replied, "It's a woman who is really fun and makes men laugh." Even as a 10-year-old, I thought that this definition was missing some key ingredient, but it was not one that mattered to my mother. Let Yourself Go, Chapter 2. My father began to contemplate retirement in the early 1980s and thought computers might be a suitable focus for his newly acquired free time. When Nick spotted a computer seminar, we thought that this would be the perfect introduction. As the speaker tried to explain the difference between RAM and ROM, I could see that he was rapidly losing his older audience. Eyes were glazing over. Then one older gentleman raised his hand and asked a simple question about spreadsheets. Who types in all the information into the computer? The speaker was visibly nonplussed by this question, shrugged his shoulders, and said, "Why, you do, of course." I could see all of my father's age group absolutely shut down, and the speaker totally lost his audience. My father's working life came equipped with a secretary, and I don't think he knew how to type. The only vague sense that he had of computers was that they were supposed to make his life easier. This clearly was not going to happen if he not only had to learn how to type, but also know what to type in if he wanted to use the computer to prepare a spreadsheet. From that point on, my father just let new technology go. Occasionally he would ask, "What is this cyberspace?" Nick emerged from some family event exulting that he had finally explained cyberspace to my father, but multiple other family members chimed in that they had provided the same explanation. Basically, Dad wasn't really interested in cyberspace and he just used it as a conversation device. He had decided that it wasn't worth it to keep up with technology and that he was old enough to manage without it. After he retired, he developed two hobbies that probably had not changed since Ooga Magook invented the wheel. He would spend hours in his woodshop with sandpaper, a screwdriver, hammer, rags, and other simple tools. At his hobby farm, he could be found in the barn in his fancy cable-knit sweater, shoveling manure or lifting hay bales onto a cart. This strategy worked for about 20 years, but as technology evolved at a dizzying pace, he suddenly found himself totally out of touch with technologies that had now been woven into everyday life: microwaves, cell phones, and the internet. One day, I spent a great deal of time trying to explain to Dad the difference between a microwave and an oven. Of course, adding to the challenge was the fact that my father was a traditional husband who had never cooked anything and probably didn't want to learn anyway. I painstakingly explained that while you could put tin foil in the oven, you could not put it in the microwave, and while you could put saran wrap in the microwave, you could not put it in the oven. The next day I arrived and was horrified to see that he was heating up a styrofoam cup in the oven. Although I considered the difference between a microwave and oven pathetically obvious, I also realized that this type of distinction might be difficult to keep straight if I was starting from square one, as my father was. Another time he was at our house and spotted a bicycle cable that was tightly coiled and had a fancy-looking lock holding the coil in place. "Is that a new kind of computer?" he asked. I initially thought I might be in the same realm as the psychiatrist who had written the book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Then I realized that my father had no concept of what a computer might look like and probably had only heard how computers were getting smaller and smaller and turning into laptops. We have a basic strategy for whenever my father comes to dinner, involving the good scotch, shrimp with cocktail sauce, no vegetables, and after dinner some sort of internet demonstration. He has been particularly interested in Google Earth, where we were able to show him an aerial view of his own backyard, his childhood home, and the boarding school he absolutely detested. Iron ore ships on the Great Lakes or antique cars are other abiding interests. But even as he was looking at the amazing technology of the internet, his basic question had not changed in 25 years. "Who types in all this stuff?" he asked. I tell this story not to poke fun at a lovely older man, but to wonder if I am unwittingly making similar decisions that will come back to haunt me. Without at least a toehold on a virtually vertical learning curve, in several years I could be as befuddled as my father. Maybe I've already made this fateful error. I have never really needed a cell phone, as most of my work is done from home with minimal travel demands. Additionally, I felt that I was making a noble, if wrong-headed, statement about the folly of instant access. One time on a business trip, I was supposed to be picked up at the airport by a car service. When there was no sign of a ride, I realized the folly of not having a cell phone. It was late at night, and there were few stores open, so I had to wander around looking for change for the payphone. 10 minutes later, I was again wandering around, looking for a payphone. When I finally called the car service number, the phone rang in the pocket of the slovenly person sitting next to the phone, eating a greasy hamburger. My ride had been sitting right next to me. Now I get extremely anxious if we are driving in a car and Nick hands me his cell phone to make a call. While the first generation of cell phones resembled real phones, 20 years later, and umpteen successive generations of blending cell phones with computers and hi-fis, his cell phone bears no relationship to what I would consider a phone. In fact, it looks like a miniaturized airline cockpit. Nick would get exasperated as he once again tried to guide me through the steps, which involved double-clicking, scrolling, and negotiating a minuscule keyboard. In one instance, I hesitated and held one key down too long, and the phone interpreted this as a signal to call the last number received, and I ended up calling myself. Clickers now dominate our lives. As a child, I was amazed that my parents grew up without a TV. Now, my children are amazed that I grew up watching TV without a clicker. A profusion of household appliances now come with clickers, including a floor fan, where one of the clicker selections is Breeze, which translates to a random selection of fan speeds to simulate the real outdoors. We stayed in a ski condo once, where the table in the living room had six clickers artfully arranged in a fan shape. I knew there was no way that I could decipher this array, and actually was looking forward to a weekend of cards and board games. However, the teenager in our midst got both the DVD and TV up and running in no time. I have tenuous control over our own TV clicker, but often call on Nick for more problematic issues. One time the dog rolled over on the clicker and the TV went black. This situation was only resolved by a phone call to India. As part of Nick's job, he often visits his clients in their home. One of his value-added services is to coordinate clickers, if needed. So what do I keep, and what do I let go? I will think about that this afternoon as I seek refuge in digging weeds with a shovel.